Okay, let me make sure. Everybody hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Good? Turn this one off. How's that?
Better?
Okay. In 1945, George Orwell wrote his classic novel, Animal Farm. Meant as a satire of Soviet communism under Stalin, it tells the story of barnyard animals who rise up under the leadership of the pig Napoleon to overthrow the negligent and alcoholic Farmer Jones, only to realize as time goes on that they have merely traded one oppressor for another, maybe much worse. This is a reading from Animal Farm. As Clover looked down the hillside, her eyes filled with tears. If she could have spoken her thoughts, it would have been to say that this was not what they had aimed at when they had set themselves years ago to work for the overthrow of the human race. These scenes of terror and slaughter were not what they had looked forward to on that night when old Major first stirred them to rebellion. If she herself had had any picture of the future, it had been of a society of animals set free from hunger and the whip, all equal, each working according to his capacity, the strong protecting the weak, as she had protected lost brood of ducklings with her foreleg on the night of Major's speech. Instead, she did not know why, they had come to a time when no one dared speak his mind, when fierce, growling dogs roamed everywhere, and when you had to watch your comrades torn to pieces after confessing to shocking crimes. There was no thought of rebellion or disobedience in her mind. She knew that even as things were, they were far better off than they had been in the days of Jones, and that before all else, it was needful to prevent the return of the human beings. Whatever happened, she would remain faithful, work hard, carry out the orders that were given to her, and accept the leadership of Napoleon. But still, it was not for this that she and all the other animals had hoped and toiled. It was not for this that they had built the windmill and faced the bullets of Jones' gun. Such were her thoughts, though she lacked the words to express them. I don't know how many people remember last fall when we had the former police officer speak.
Yes.
And he talked about things that he had been asked to do on the police force that he did not feel comfortable with. That talk really struck me at the time because at that time, last fall, I was serving as a member of the grand jury here in Galveston County. And I knew that what he was saying, I felt that that's what I was seeing in the grand jury room. So I wanted to talk to you, and I wanted to tell you about my experience being on the grand jury, because I think that that's a glimpse into the criminal justice system that not a lot of people get to have. So last fall, September around, I received a summons to appear at the courthouse on October the 2nd. So, you know, very serious, I felt. But I figured that because I was a lawyer and a defense attorney, I would not get selected. The prosecutors generally want to be the only lawyer in the room. Unfortunately for them, out of the 160 people summoned to appear, only 30 showed up. The prosecutor did not ask any questions and only asked the people on one side of the aisle if they wanted to serve. You people over here. That's where I was. I wanted to serve, so I just sat there. Once we got back into the grand jury room and the prosecutor overseeing the grand jury started asking about people's individual backgrounds, he was not happy that I was on. And he made that quite obvious. In fact, out of the 14 people selected, 2 were lawyers. One was a paralegal. and one person worked for the Attorney General's office in child support enforcement. Needless to say, this prosecutor was not very happy. So the grand jury consists of 12 people and two alternates. They meet one day a week for 3 months. We were paid $50 a day. I think they need to put that in the initial letter. I think more people might have shown up, because I think most people thought they were just going to get that $6 a day that they pay you on jury duty, but no, it ended up being a pretty healthy amount. Each day we signed in, and at our seats was a 3 to 4 page sheet of felony cases. So between 75 and 100 cases. I think the least amount maybe was 25, the most we got was about 200. The facts of each case were presented by several prosecuting attorneys, and our job was to determine whether probable cause existed that the individual selected that was being charged had actually committed the offense. Probable cause was defined for us as more likely than not. So for a felony case to move forward, at least 9 people on the grand jury must vote to what's called true-bill a case. Otherwise, the case is no-billed and the defendant is released. The first day we had an orientation. The orientation consisted in the morning of law enforcement officers that handled drug offenses to come in and instruct the individual, the grand jury, on the various aspects of drug cases. What drugs look like, what amounts they're sold in, how much they're sold for, did they smell a particular way, whatever. In the afternoon, we had the prosecutor that dealt with family violence cases to talk about some ins and outs of those. It was interesting, but I couldn't help thinking that the purpose of the orientation was to make sure that we understood all those fancy forensics that you see on television on shows like CSI. You're not going to see any of that in this jurisdiction, okay? We're talking no fingerprints, no blood splatter, DNA, bruising. In fact, the family violence prosecutor made a point of pointing out that when women are choked, there's really no bruising that occurs. I wasn't sure if this was because the pictures were taken right after the fact, so it just hadn't shown up. I don't know about that. And that turned out to be true. We didn't see that kind of evidence. Some aspects of group dynamics began to show up during the first meeting. The prosecutor overseeing the grand jury made a point of extolling our virtues, how much we were appreciated, what a great job we were doing, what wonderful citizens and human beings we were. He talked about how many people had reviewed the cases before they got to us. This was law enforcement and the prosecutors, of course. He reiterated ad nauseum that he had no personal stake in whether the cases got true billed or no billed, and that he was only presenting what law enforcement had given to him. He basically went through this spiel every time anyone asked a question. Of course, I felt the message being, don't ask questions. Smarter people than you have reviewed these cases and have determined that they need to move forward. Your job is already done just by virtue of you showing up. You've already done your duty. At the beginning, this worked with most of the people who were intimidated to ask questions. But of course, this did not hold true for the people that were already familiar with the criminal justice system. Myself and the other attorneys started asking questions right from the start. This turned out to really motivate others in the group to start asking questions. Particularly if we felt that the police had overreached in some aspect, or that the state was delving into areas where it really had no business. I was surprised to find that even having had a lot of experience with the criminal justice system, I came into that process with the same misconceptions that I feel that many people have, simply from watching the news. So let me start with what I got right. I believe that the system was overclogged with drug cases, and in fact, it is. It is overwhelmingly clogged with drug cases. At least two-thirds to one-half of cases every week were drug cases. Use, these are possession amounts. These are not distribution amounts. Cocaine, methamphetamine, and PCP. It was interesting that almost nobody that we talked to cared about marijuana. Law enforcement didn't care. Prosecutors didn't care. Said if it was legalized, they didn't care. Almost 100% of these drug arrests were involved in traffic stops. Almost every person that was arrested had prior arrests for drugs. We weren't supposed to take prior arrests into consideration in determining probable cause, but this particular prosecutor told us about priors in every single case. So I think this is how it goes. I think you have an old model car driving around or parked at a park or parked at a parking lot late at night. And the police run the license plate and they determine that the registered owner of the vehicle has prior arrests for drugs. Ding, 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 ding. At this point, they're going to figure out a reason to stop the person. Now, apparently being parked at a park or in a parking lot is just suspicious, just in and of itself. Otherwise, there were some reasons to stop that I felt might not have been entirely valid. Failure to signal within 100 feet of a stop sign. This is apparently an extremely common reason to stop someone, although I've never been stopped for that reason. Light burned out on license plate. We had one failure to stop at a stop sign while riding a bicycle. Or my favorite, furtive gestures. Gestures. Okay. Furtive gestures is apparently you see a cop car behind you and you begin to act in a nervous manner, reaching around you. If you happen to be like reaching in the glove compartment or the visor, don't do that. Though these are fairly common places where people might keep their vehicle registration, they're also very common places that people hide drugs. So that will get you stopped. The police officers then ask the driver if they can search the vehicle. Probable cause to stop does not necessarily mean probable cause to search. In order to search, they must be able to articulate probable cause or they're granted consent. If you have consent, you don't need probable cause. So just say no, as Nancy Reagan would say, because then they have to come up with an actual reason. Most people, however, and you know, bear in mind that these are people that usually had multiple prior arrests for drugs. They're still driving around with drugs in their cars. Just do it at home. And apparently a lot of people don't understand that they don't have to give consent to search their vehicle or your home. Okay. Now the police might raise a fuss. They might want to give you a field sobriety test, but again, have to have probable cause for that. They might tell you they're going to go get the drug-sniffing dogs. I think they might have one canine unit in Galveston County. I don't know. But usually these things are not going to happen. This is where we saw the most cases that we tended to know, Bill. And that's because even if they found drugs in the car, I think that the people in the grand jury felt that a message needed to be sent to the police that these made-up reasons to stop people were not going to be condoned. Sometimes you need to send a message to the state. Just because you broke the law once, also, does not give the police the right to target you over and over and over again. So that was what I got right. Can move on to the misconceptions. There were a lot more of those. If you watch the news, you might think, and I watch the Houston news, that most crime is committed by young African American males. You might get the impression that home invasions are common or that gun violence is prevalent. There's certainly a lot of talk in this country about guns. The first misconception that I realized was all crime is not committed by men. There weren't a lot of women in the military, so I didn't see that much. This was probably the most startling for me to see how many women commit crimes and the variety of the crimes that they commit. Usually about 35% of the cases that we looked at were female alleged perpetrators. Of course, you have the drug possession and the check kiting, that writing bad checks. That's fairly common. Sadly, DUI is common among women. To be a felony, that has to be your third DUI. These women were almost always driving around with their children in the car. During the day, driving around drunk with your kids in the car. Most shocking, however, was the number of violent crimes that were committed by women. Just a word of advice, men. After a long day of drinking and drug use with your significant other, if you are motivated somehow to confess to her that you've been cheating, don't do it. She will go in the kitchen and get a knife and stab you with it. I cannot tell you how many times we saw that the scenario played out. Pick up a large object, in one case a big industrial wrench, and hit you over the head with it. These are aggravated assault cases. Definitely the knife is the weapon of choice for women, however. Theft is also common among women. Walmart is the preferred shoplifting venue. You figured that. And breaking into convenience stores late at night to steal cigarettes and baby formula. Evidently, there's a huge black market in baby formula. There was one woman that was obviously a career criminal. We saw two or three cases of her. And this was breaking into convenience stores late at night. All the prosecutors knew her. All the law enforcement knew her. I don't know why she wasn't just in jail, but evidently that's the revolving door going on. The second misconception is that minorities are more likely to be indicted. There certainly have been some high-profile cases that indicated that. There may be racial profiling going on at different places in the system, but in the grand jury, in my experience, race was not mentioned. The sheet of offenses that we were given had no race noted on it. You rarely get a picture of the perpetrator. You're usually getting a photo of the victim if the prosecutors are presenting evidence. So at least for my experience, we did not know the race of the people that we were indicting. The grand jury itself was fairly representative, I think, of Galveston County. 7 white, 4 Hispanic, and 1 African American. 5 women and 7 men, 5 probably over 40, I can't be sure, but I think so, and the rest younger. The third misconception is that gun violence is common. In the over 1,000 cases that we reviewed, I recall a gun being used in only one case. And that was a murder involving rival drug dealers. If guns were mentioned in cases at all, it usually had to do with the drug stops finding a weapon in the car with somebody that wasn't supposed to have one. Ironically, too, guns seem to be a popular thing to steal when you're breaking into a house. People will break in because it's a thing of value to steal the gun collection. Really, most of the violence that we saw, if it wasn't the knife, and I think most of the violence that we saw, were people just using their bare hands, punching, kicking, choking, slapping. Okay. And lastly, the misconception I had was that you have a lot to fear from strangers. I honestly don't recall a single instance of stranger-on-stranger crime. Now, whereas you may not have a lot to fear from strangers, you do apparently have a great deal to fear from your family and friends. Violence against family members is extremely common. And this engendered a lot of discussion in the grand jury room. Some of the people on the grand jury felt that the police should let family members fight it out if it was apparent that there was a mutual affray, like in siblings duking it out with each other, particularly if it was the nosy neighbor who reported the offense. Those cases were generally true billed because there was a lot of evidence there. I remember once siblings were fighting over the ranch dressing at dinner. This did not mean that the brother could then choke his sister until she passed out. We saw cases of contractors that people had invited into their homes stealing checks and trying to pass them. We saw cases of children burglarizing their parents' homes to steal their cash or the gun collection, children and their friends. So whereas you might not need the assault rifle to protect you from roving bands of marauders wanting to break into your house to murder you, you do need to be very nice to your family and friends. Pay your contractors fairly and give your children a good allowance. Of course, the saddest cases we saw involved child abuse. We didn't see many of those, thankfully, but it was always a family member that was accused of the offense. Probably the case that hit everyone the hardest, just because it was so violent and mean, involved a case of animal abuse. And this was between neighbors. These were the cases that we couldn't true bill fast enough. In the end, we all seemed to enjoy our time on the grand jury. People asked if they could serve again. And I miss some of those people because they were very interesting people. I generally respected the opinions of all the people in my group, and even though some had biases, felt that some crimes were more serious than others, we were generally in agreement. I started this talk with a reading from Animal Farm. At the time last fall that I was planning this speech, I believed that totalitarianism was very far off. Today, maybe not so far. It is important to note that as positive as my experience on the grand jury was, the whisper of something far more sinister was still present. There were a couple of gentlemen that I believed would have true-billed every case no matter what. One in particular became downright nasty anytime the tactics of law enforcement were questioned. There was an attitude from the same two of, well, let's just true bill the case and let the prosecutors and defense attorneys fight it out in court. This prompted the other lawyer in the group to talk about how damaging it was to a person to have a felony indictment on their record, and that we were not there to merely be a rubber stamp. And that really struck people, I think, from that point on. There was the subtle or not so subtle message from the one prosecutor not to ask questions because smarter people than you have already made a decision. In the novel Animal Farm, the character traits that made up the good animals, their loyalty, trust in authority, and belief in the inherent good of all, were the very characteristics that allowed them to be so easily manipulated by those who sought to do so. On the grand jury, I think some people's shyness and insecurity about their lack of knowledge of the system caused them to be hesitant to speak out when they had a question. It's always easier to go along and allow the loudest voice in the room to prevail. But we know from history that this can be catastrophic. It is as important now as it was in 1945 to be ever vigilant in guarding our civil rights and preserving our freedoms. Take your civic responsibility seriously. Get involved even if you think you don't have time. And whoever the loudest voice in the room happens to be, if you disagree with them, yell louder. Thank you.